Okay. Hello, everybody. So today we will continue on with volume 4. Look how much we've done. We're getting there. How long have we been on volume 4? Three countless great eons. What? April 2024. April. Oh, so a year and a half. That's not too bad. Okay. So we've been on the section of the three higher trainings for a while, and in particular here, the higher training of concentration. So last week, we talked about the six super knowledges, different powers that people can develop once they have serenity, and even beyond serenity, when they can enter the beyond the initial serenity, I should say, and when they enter into the jhanas. And so we finished that section last week. This week, we're going to start on another section. We don't have too much to go on in this chapter. And the section we're going to start on is the value of the super knowledges for bodhisattvas. Because when you hear the super knowledges, it's like, it seems, you know, well, miraculous, doesn't it? Yeah, the supernormal powers physically that you have, you know, being able to see past lives and see sentient beings dying and being reborn, knowing your own past lives, all these kinds of things. So it's, you know, something to know that some people have actualized these. This is how they've done it. And in the future, yeah, then we will be able to do that. I wouldn't aim for it now, yeah, because I think most of us need to learn how to be good, solid practitioners first, yeah. There's a chair over here, if you want to sit. Yeah, we need to learn how to be good human beings. Yeah. And once we do that, then on the basis of that, we can do the rest of the Dharma practice, yeah? But we really have to get our life in order and have develop some emotional regulation so we're not just like a yo-yo, and, you know, and get our ethical conduct kind of in good shape so that we can get along well with other people and so that we feel good about ourselves. Yeah. Okay, so let's start with visualizing the merit field in the space in front. We're surrounded by all the sentient beings. So there's a government shutdown now, and so many people are experiencing difficulties. Many people who are federal workers are not getting paid during the shutdown. Some have been laid off. And there's a lot of confusion and not very pleasant talk among people in Congress. So it's good to visualize all those people around us too and think that they're turning to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha for refuge. And then as we, you know, do the chanting and light comes from the three jewels into us. Think that they're going into the president, the vice president, all the people in the Senate, all the people in the House, and making everybody's mind peaceful, yeah, and everybody's mind compassionate and kind, so that they can work together for the benefit of the country. And then let's cultivate our motivation. So this is the time of year when at the Abbey we have lots of bugs, all different kinds of bugs. They fly, they walk around, they love to come in the buildings and see what's going on here. So it's important to remember, you know, because we always hear all sentient beings can become Buddhas, all sentient beings have the Buddha nature, that all these bugs can become Buddhas and they have the Buddha nature. So maybe not in this life will they be able to practice the path and become Buddhas, but they are not bereft of the possibility in future lives of leaving behind the lower realms forever and encountering the Dharma, practicing it, gaining realizations, and then in turn being able to lead other beings in the Dharma. So it's interesting to pick different groups of people from time to time and really focus on them, like, they have the Buddha nature, they can become Buddhas. Yeah. So it really changes how we think about bugs. Yeah, we have to respect them. And if we respect the Buddha nature in bugs, then certainly we have to respect the Buddha nature in human beings, even if we don't like them, don't get along with them, they have harmed us, or whatever. In other words, nobody is inherently evil, and we cannot give up on anybody. So everybody has that beautiful potential. So remembering that, then we can aspire to fulfill our potential and become fully awakened Buddhas. And then with care and compassion and skillful means and wisdom, then contribute to the welfare of all other living beings. So let's generate that motivation. Okay, so in the book, we are on page 253. Okay, the section, the value of the super knowledges for bodhisattvas. Okay, so I'll read from His Holiness what he said and then stop every so often. Although some Shravakas choose to develop the first five super knowledges, others do not. Okay, when I was in Thailand some years ago, you know, helping to research for the book, the English-speaking monks, you know, told me a lot about, you know, kind of like there's different kinds of arhats in the sense that there are some who attain arhatship with just the access concentration, some with higher levels of concentration, yeah. They have different names for those. Some arhats take the time and put the energy in to develop supernormal powers. Some don't. Some have developed the other super knowledges and some, you know, haven't. So it's, you know, kind of according to people's wish. The one thing, of course, they all have in common is the realization of emptiness and, of course, renunciation from samsara. And so that's the crucial things that enable them to become arhats. Okay, so although some shravakas choose to develop the first five super knowledges, others do not. However, these are crucial for bodhisattvas because they enable bodhisattvas to accumulate great merit that is dedicated to full awakening, and they enable both bodhisattvas and Buddhas to be of great benefit to sentient beings. Okay, so now he's going to go through and show how each one of the super knowledges helps bodhisattvas benefit sentient beings. Okay, so with supernormal powers, bodhisattvas go to pure lands where they listen to Dharma teachings directly from various Buddhas. Yeah, great. Yeah, then no need to set up a whole AV system, you know. Yeah, yeah, you like that, huh? Yeah, no, you wanna go to the pure land, no AV system to set up. Okay. In pure lands, they create enormous merit by emanating abundant and magnificent offerings that they offer to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas there. So they emanate these offerings. They don't need to go shopping, yeah, to buy food and different things to offer, but through their supernormal powers, they manifest those things and offer them. In the human realm, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas benefit others by revealing these powers to specific disciples to enhance their faith and joyous effort. So the key word here is specific disciples. In other words, they do not show these powers just to anybody, and hardly to anybody, actually. And they probably don't sit their disciples down and say, okay, now I'm going to do this display of all my powers. I don't think so. It would probably be, it requires the disciples being sharp to be able to pick things up, you know, that there's teachers do that are quite beneficial to other sentient beings, and be able to pick that up. Okay, so they do so, when they display those powers, very discreetly, with no wish to gain reputation or fame. Yeah. So if you're seeking reputation and fame, the bodhisattva path is not for you. Yeah. And, if you practice read the thought training texts, then you understand why, because the thought training texts, the whole energy behind them is humility, getting rid of the self-centered thought. Yeah. So they do so discreetly with no wish to gain reputation or fame. Buddhas and bodhisattvas can also manifest many bodies, appearing as ordinary individuals in diverse places to teach and guide the beings there. And when they do so, they don't announce themselves. Yeah, they don't say, okay, I'm here, I'm a bodhisattva, I'm going to be a Buddha soon. You can put your offerings here and you can bow down to me there, because I'm a Buddha and I'm going to benefit you. No. Okay. Yeah. I say this because there's something in us. We would really like some kind of exciting something like this, you know? Yeah. But sometimes it's better for things not to be so exciting. Yeah. Okay. In addition, these miraculous abilities enable bodhisattvas to know where their spiritual mentors Dharma friends and disciples with whom they have karma connections are living and to go there quickly to either receive or to give teachings and guidance. Okay? So if you're a bodhisattva, you want to study particular texts with specific teachers, you know where those teachers are, and because you have those supernormal powers, you can fly in the sky and go through walls and walk on water and so on, you can get to the teaching site very quickly. Yeah, no ticket. I don't think they have a require a visa, you know. It depends how you enter the country. If you manifest as a human being before you enter the country, then you have to show your visa. Otherwise, you know, they just kind of bop in. Okay. So they know where their spiritual mentors are. They know where their Dharma friends are. So if you want to do retreat and you want to have Dharma friends nearby, which is always good to do when you're doing retreat, you know where they are. Yeah, you'll remember after the Buddha attained awakening, the first thing he did was he thought, who can I teach? And he thought first of his two prior teachers, but they had both passed away. And then he thought of his five friends that he had eaten one grain of rice each with for 6 years. And he then walked to Benares to teach them. Okay, Dharma friends, and these bodhisattvas also know where disciples are. You know, and the disciples with whom they have karmic connections. Yeah, so this is quite important, you know, just the karmic connection. And I think a lot of it happens because of previous lives connection with different people. Because, you know, there was one way, of course, we're making connections when we are actually in this life, listening to teachings or serving different teachers or whatever. You know, we make a connection that way. Sorry, I'm trying to talk loud to the back of the room. That's my habit. And I have to change that habit. Okay. So, can you still hear me if I talk? You can? Oh, wow. Okay. So, let's see if I can speak softly. Then I also saw when Kyabche Song Rinpoche was in Los Angeles, the previous one, not the present one, but his predecessor. We took him to the beach one day, and this was in California, and there were all sorts of sea anemones, you know, those little creatures, and if you, they're kind of open at the top, and if you dangle something in, that's how they catch the food, you know, they start to close. So Rinpoche, you know, had his mala, and he kept kind of touching the sea anemones, and they would start to close. And initially I was thinking, why is he doing that, you know? And then I realized he's making a karmic connection with them. Yeah. And, you know, there's all sorts of different ways to make karmic connections. Zopa Rinpoche, whenever there's a roadkill, yeah. Whenever there's a road kill, he'll ask the person to stop, and then he'll go and recite lots of mantras, you know, and texts and things like that to make that karmic connection and bless their mind. Okay, so there's many ways to do that. When we first started having teachings, we were in Ananda Hall, and so the kiddies all attended teachings. Yeah, good imprints. And some of them attended they all attended the teachings much more regularly than the human beings did. You know, the human beings, well, you know, I'm tired today. No. Yeah, but And they were very good. Well, they usually were very good. Once in a while, one of them would chase the other. But usually they just curled up and slept, just like the human disciples. So, you know, there's ways to make that connection. So if you know that through clairvoyant powers, then you can go and establish that connection again in this lifetime and benefit them. Okay. Then, so that's was the first one, the supernormal powers. Then the second super knowledge is clairaudience. So you can hear things. Yeah. So by means of clairaudience, bodhisattvas can hear teachings in other places and understand all languages. This enables them to understand a wide range of teachings and to know their students' Dharma discussions. With this knowledge, bodhisattvas have the ability to resolve their students' doubts and dispel their misconceptions. Okay, so they can hear teachings in other places even without going there, and develop that wisdom from hearing those teachings. They can also understand all the languages, which is really important, because when you think today where Buddhism is spread, it's being taught in quite a number of different languages. Yeah, so if you don't happen to speak one of them as a human being, if you have this supernormal power, knowledge power, then you can hear the teaching in your own language. And they say that whenever a Buddha teaches, everybody hears it in their own language. When Shakyamuni Buddha was alive, yeah. So no need for translators. You can retire. But not yet. Okay. And so the clairaudience, then the teachers also, they can hear their students discussing or debating the Dharma. They can tell when they're stuck on a certain point or if something isn't clear, if they've misunderstood. So all these kinds of powers, you know, really enables them to be of a great benefit to a number of people. Okay, they can, they have the ability then to resolve their students' doubts and dispel their misconceptions. So I think I told you before, when I was studying at the library in Dharamsala with Geshe Sonam Rinchen, there was another Western nun there, and we would, Annie Karen, and we would meet together in the evening and circumambulate and discuss the teachings that Geshe La gave during the day. And lots of times we would come up with questions when we were walking around. And then next day, when Geshe La's teaching, he answered our questions. You know, so, you know, it could be coincidence, or maybe it's not. I don't know. But it was certainly very good, because we had a lot of questions. Yeah. Okay. Then the third super knowledge was knowledge of others' minds. So here's how it benefits sentient beings. Through knowledge of others' minds, bodhisattvas directly know others' interests and dispositions, as well as their emotional patterns and habitual thoughts, and thus can teach them accordingly. Now just think about it, you know, because we're, even when we offered the mandala before this teaching, we're asking the Buddha to teach according to the disposition, you know, of each sentient being, because everybody has different dispositions, different interests, and so on. And so this ability, if you can know others' minds, then you know kind of what is best to teach them, how to teach them, what to do, you know, explain first, what second, where they're going to get stuck, and how you can help them through that. So it's very helpful to to have knowledge of their minds, to know their emotional patterns, and to know, you know, which people you can talk straight to and which people you have to sugarcoat with, because, you know, people are quite different, and if you want them to hear the message, you have to say it in a way that they can take it in. Yeah. And so that can be really different, you know, from one person to the next. Okay. So they know their emotional patterns, habitual thoughts. Yeah. So they're going to know if which students are always daydreaming, which ones are, you know, kind of practicing well, and so on. So very helpful. So, and they also know whose mind is under the influence of afflictions and whose mind is free from afflictions. So they know people's level of realization. That is the level that is below them. Yeah. Yeah, and they know when they're dealing with different people whose mind is under an affliction at that moment and whose isn't. Although we kind of can tell that too with people, can't we? Yeah, we ignore it, but we often can tell. Cherishing others more than themselves, bodhisattvas are never judgmental when they see that someone's mind is overcome with afflictions. Instead, their compassion and determination to help that person increase. Wow. What do? When we hear, you know, not even with these kind of powers, but we hear somebody saying things that we don't agree with. Yeah. Do we say, oh my goodness, that person's mind is overcome by afflictions. How can I help them? No, we usually say that what that person is thinking is crazy and what they're saying is totally wrong. You know, what in the world is going on with that person? So lots of judgment in there. Okay, but not with these bodhisattvas. Okay, then the fourth super knowledge is knowing past lives. So here's what His Holiness explains about them. By means of knowing past lives, bodhisattvas know their spiritual mentors, dharma practices, and spiritual friends from previous lives, and thus seek them out again in this life. So that's kind of similar to the, you know, the previous ones that enable you to contact teachers and dharma friends and students. Okay. So studying and practicing under the guidance of teachers with whom they have associated and in whom they have deep trust and faith from previous lives, and continuing practices in which they have already trained in previous lives, enables them to progress rapidly. So that's a big thing going both ways. If you're the bodhisattva, you know, being able to find teachers that you've had that connection with in previous lives, yeah, then when you know, often when you meet them in this life, that connection is still there. Yeah. It's always good to not just assume that they're going to be your teacher in this life. You know, I'm talking about people at our level now. You know, when you have this ability, then you'll know if they're a good teacher or not one, not only if you have a karmic connection or not, but you know, to see, especially when they're identified, when they're little, to wait for them to grow up and really see what they turn into as they grow up. Because this isn't old Tibet, you know. In old Tibet, when you ordain, you know, or especially if you were recognized as an incarnation, there weren't a lot of other things you could get distracted by and things that you had the choice of doing. You stayed put where you were. Now, oh my goodness, you know, it's like everything. And that can, you know, the monasteries in South India, it's difficult because the young monks, you know, see Westerners, they see television, all sorts of, you know, the wealth in other countries, and it's very easy for them to get distracted, you know, from their studies and practice. Okay. So, and then especially, again, they can, bodhisattvas can seek out people, disciples and Dharma friends, not only teachers, that they have a karmic connection with from previous lives. Yeah. There were a couple of my teachers who, there was one young lama, and he was recognized as the incarnation of their teacher. Yeah. And he, they always kind of felt like he was that. But then when he was very little, he started reciting texts that he had memorized in his previous life. Yeah, so you have a little kid all of a sudden reciting Lekshe Ningpo or, Ornament to Clear Realization, something like that. And so that, you know, he remembered from previous lives. And I think it, you know, he was reciting some of these when he was kind of half asleep, you know, when he was dreaming and doing the recitation. So that really clinched it, you know. Studying and practicing under the guidance of teachers with whom they have associated and in whom they have deep trust and faith from previous lives and continuing practices in which they have already trained in previous lives enables them to progress rapidly. Yeah, so if you have done a certain practice in one life, to be able to meet the teacher that taught it to you in this life and learn it again, it's kind of like a head start. In addition, they know the disciples with whom they have had Dharma connections in previous lives and continue to guide and teach them. By clearly seeing the karma that their disciples have created in the past, these bodhisattvas understand their disciples' present experiences and tendencies and know how to guide them effectively. So the more knowledge you have about a person's background and way of thinking, the better it is, the more you know how to guide them. Yeah. So that's kind of one reason, you know, you can gain this with teachers who don't have so many disciples because there's the time to talk to them individually. With teachers like His Holiness, who have zillions of disciples, very difficult. But of course, His Holiness, I think, has those powers, although he would never, ever admit it, and, teaches us accordingly. Okay, then the next one, the divine eye. This is the fifth super knowledge. The divine eye enables bodhisattvas to know others' karmic tendencies as well as where they have been reborn. They also know the karmic results of actions that people are doing now, which helps them to guide their disciples more effectively. So if you see people doing certain negative actions now, then when you teach or when you talk to that individual, you kind of guide them about what to do to purify. Yeah. Clairvoyance gives bodhisattvas the ability to discern sentient beings' karmic receptivity to the Dharma and to interact with them accordingly. Yeah, so that's important, you know, to know people's receptivity. Otherwise, you know, there may be somebody who wants to sit and talk with a teacher and they want to talk and talk, you know, and tell their whole life story and talk about the news and the sports teams and so on. And the teacher will be able to pick up probably sooner rather than later that, you know, this is a person who, you know, maybe isn't so serious about learning Dharma, and so, you know, they won't spend as much time with that person, but put their time more on the people who they know are more serious. Although, you know, who knows what their karma, what your karmic relationships are from previous lives. There could be somebody who you were close to in a previous life, not in a Dharma way, but then this lifetime you meet them in a Dharma way, and because of that previous closeness, you can benefit them. So, you know, we don't have those powers, or at least I don't, but if you have those kind of powers, then it makes it very easy, to see where it's valuable to use your time and so on. Okay, it enables the divine eye, also enables them to locate their previous disciples and benefit them in their present life form. Oh, hopefully they don't have to benefit us if we're reborn as dogs or cats or stink bugs. And, you know, in the monasteries in India and also in Tibet, there's always so many dogs around the monasteries. And the monks say these are the incarnations of people who did not keep their precepts very well. But then some of those dogs hang out with one monk or another, maybe because they were friends in a previous life, yeah? Okay, understanding others' minds, bodhisattvas know who has entered the path and their level of realization, as well as who has not entered the path, and thus can guide all these beings accordingly. So somebody may say, I've attained, you know, path of accumulation or whatever, path of seeing, you know, but a bodhisattva will be able to tell what's really going on, or, you know, when they have these powers. And then the sixth one, so those first five are all mundane super-knowledges, so people who, you know, even non-Buddhists can generate those. But the sixth one, the knowledge of the destruction of pollutants, is only for Arya Bodhisattvas, or actually, Bodhisattvas of the eighth bhumi, eighth ground. And probably arhats too. So with knowledge of the destruction of pollutants, bodhisattvas of the pure grounds know their own level of spiritual attainments, fortifying their confidence and their ability to benefit others. In short, some of these super knowledges involved extrasensory perception by means other than our five senses. Other super knowledges involve supernormal powers, special physical powers that affect how one's body interacts with the surrounding environment. Okay. Then His Holiness continues. Since we are discussing these special abilities that most people do not have, I would like to make a few comments. So here are his comments. When I posed questions to my senior tutor, Kyabche Ling Rinpoche, he would sometimes give strange answers. I began to suspect that he had other sources of knowledge. So once I asked him, do you have clairvoyant experiences? Yeah, you have to be very close to a teacher to ask that question. Yeah, otherwise it's extremely not the question to ask. Okay. So Ling Rinpoche responded, I don't know, but sometimes certain unusual types of knowledge seem to arise in me. You see the humility there? Yes, I have that power. I don't know. Sometimes things arise, yeah. So Ling Rinpoche was a knowledgeable spiritual master with great integrity, and I had known him since I was a child. Therefore, I trust him and believe that clairvoyance and other super knowledges exist. Theoretically, the ability to know is a natural property of the consciousness. Yeah, the nature of the mind is clear and cognizant. That's its nature, to know objects. Yeah. Even in our ordinary experiences, we sometimes have premonitions of what might happen. I think these indicate that the seed for such cognitive powers lies within us. Okay, now so that's what we might call intuition. So some people really trust their intuition. Yeah. Personally, I do not trust my intuition at all. You know, it is usually wrong. So, you know, you get different feelings about, oh, this might happen, that might happen. Okay, put it in the nomtope pile. Yeah, the superstitious conceptualizations pile. But some people, you know, their intuition is different. I guess they trust it. Okay. Even in our ordinary experiences, we sometimes have premonitions of what might happen. I think these indicate that the seed for such cognitive powers lies within us. Me too? I don't think so. Everybody else has intuition that's good, but not me. You guys look bored. It's a good reaction to melodrama, actually, isn't it? Somebody's being very melodrama. Okay. Through meditative practices and single-pointed concentration in particular, we begin to sharpen the focus of our memory and mindfulness, increasing our ability to recollect experiences. As the powers of recollection become sharper, the potential for precognition is enhanced as well. This is the theoretical basis for believing in precognition. I like the way he says this is a theoretical basis, you know. Yeah, I'm just speaking intellectually. Yeah, yeah. Okay, but that's interesting. The more your ability to remember from the past increases, then the more ability to have feelings about what will happen in the future. These abilities seem to arise in different forms in different people. In the 18th century, during the time of the 7th Dalai Lama, a highly realized master named Dakpo Lobsang Tenpe Gyaltsen was universally recognized as having clairvoyant powers. Chankyo Rope Dorje, another great master, asked him, "How does this knowledge arise in you?" Dakpo Lobsang Tenpe Gyaltsen replied, "Whenever I have to seriously think about something, I focus on the first image that appears in my mind. This is usually a bell. On top of that appears certain images and patterns that give me particular premonitions." Why a bell? I have no idea, but interesting, isn't it? Teachings of the highest yoga tantra contain specific practices that enable people to develop that kind of power. The sutras also speak of extrasensory perception, but that is usually only visual and auditory, never olfactory. So you don't smell things from afar. Yeah, you probably said good. Well, regarding certain smells. Okay. Even in our ordinary experiences, we can cognize objects at a distance through our visual and auditory perceptions, though we can't do this for odors. The power of clairvoyance is limited to visual forms. While extrasensory perception and supernormal powers are possible, the Buddha forbade his disciples to talk about their accomplishments in this area. One of the precepts of a fully ordained monastic is to abandon publicly proclaiming that one is an arhat or that one has special abilities. This is to ensure that practitioners remain humble. So that's letting us know that you can even have, you know, samadhi and some of these higher attainments and still fall prey to arrogance. Yeah. Some people claim to have super knowledges, but personally, I am very skeptical, as Holiness says. Because of misconceptions originating centuries ago, some people believe that many Tibetan monastics have special powers. Even me, I was walking in Singapore one day years ago, and one man stopped me and said, "What's my lucky number?" You know, I want to get a, I don't know, what do you, if you can get a specific lottery ticket or what. And I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "But you're a Tibetan monastic. Don't you know?" Yeah, I had to disappoint him and say no. Yeah. One time when I was asked to give a talk in a college in Knoxville, Tennessee, yeah, one of the students said, "Oh, and this shows you what people, what, you know, some professors who don't know much about Buddhism give to their students to read." So the students said, "Oh, I read such and such a book, you know," and they were talking about all these Tibetan monastics that, that have, you know, they can read people's minds, they know the future, they can do all these magical things. Can you do that? No, you know. And then, of course, my introduction to that world at the international school in Hong Kong, where that little boy asked me if I could bend spoons, like Uri Geller. You know, I had to disappoint him. Yeah, but, you know, they say, yeah, the Dharma is quite strict, actually, about not talking about these things, especially not lying about and saying, you know, saying you have powers you don't have. But even if you do have powers, not to talk about them, because it's very easy, you know, to start getting arrogant. And it, they say that when you talk too much about these things, that it actually goes down, you know, your ability to have these, you know, this kind of knowledge goes down, because it's becoming something that you chat about with your friends. "Oh, guess what I had in my meditation last night? Everybody come here, let me tell you." You know, and you go off on, you know, "I saw this, I saw that." And, oh, yeah, sometimes you will meet people. I was at one conference, oh, goodness. And one man, he had knew a little bit about Buddhism, and he was started telling me about how he was, I don't know if he was dreaming or, you know, he just kind of saw it when his eyes were open, but Tara came to him and Tara sat in his lap and, you know, yeah. Oh, that's very nice. Yeah, it's lunchtime. Let's go. Okay. I felt really bad for that man because it was like the feeling of him saying that was like he was quite needy inside. Yeah. And this was kind of giving him some sustenance. But it was quite sad that, you know, I had no idea what he was actually seeing or what he was, yeah. If he was just had taken drugs, he was an older man. He didn't strike me as a pothead, but, you know, you never know what's going on with people. Okay. So, furthermore, these special abilities do not necessarily propel them along the path to awakening and sometimes become a distraction to spiritual practice. Because everybody starts coming to you and says, will you do a mo for me? Yeah, will you read this for me? Will you read that? You know, and then you're just wanting to do your studies and practice and you're getting interrupted by that. It's interesting. Some of my teachers do mos and some of them do not. Yeah, and it's mostly the Rinpoches who do mos. You know, who you can ask about that. But the Geshe's don't tend to do them. Although sometimes, you know, I think privately they do. But yeah, mos are a whole other thing. You know, please, that little kit about some kind of mo kit that somebody found in our... No. Put your attention on learning the Dharma, practicing the Dharma. You know, this is not our business. Okay? Yeah, some people, you know, it's like they want a mo for everything. And, yeah. And there's an interesting story about Lama Zopa. He loves mos. And he does mos for everything, yeah, which I found was difficult when I was director of the nunnery in France, because one day we would get one instruction and then he would do another mo and you'd get another instruction. And then the next day there was, yeah. So it becomes a bit confusing. But one time, I'm thinking, all my stories are rising up. Yeah, it's not intuition, it's just story time. okay, what was the one I was just going to tell you? Oh, yes. One time I was taking care of one monk in Dharamsala. He had really bad malaria. And so I would go every day and kind of make sure he had food and water and, you know, stuff like that. And he refused to take malaria medicine. Yeah. I have no idea why. I think maybe he even thought he didn't have malaria, but he certainly had all the symptoms. So one day I went down to Geshe Namandarge, who I had never heard of him throwing mos before. But I said, Geshe-la, if you throw mos, could you throw a mo regarding this monk about if he should take Inji medicine or Tibetan medicine or no medicine at all, you know? And so Geshe did that and said, you know, take, I think it was, you know, Inji Western medicine. And I went up and told him. And he took the medicine. So that was what convinced him to take the medicine. You know, so that was good because otherwise he was not getting any better. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I got to stop with the stories. Okay, so furthermore, these special abilities do not necessarily propel them along the path to awakening and sometimes become a distraction to spiritual practice. In some cases, a person may believe they have extrasensory perception when in fact they do not. In this case, telling others that they intuit what they intuit could be inaccurate and harmful. This is especially true if they asked for if they give unasked for advice. Some people may gain extrasensory perception or supernormal powers through single-pointed concentration. When used with compassion to benefit others, some special abilities are constructive. But if these people have not cultivated compassion, there is danger that they use these powers to gain respect, material gain, or power over others, in which case such powers are useless at best and harmful at worst. The goal of the Buddhist path is not to gain supernormal powers, but to attain liberation and awakening. Therefore, these special abilities must be cultivated with the proper motivation, and practitioners must know that until they become fully awakened Buddhas, their extrasensory perception and supernormal powers are not complete and may be erroneous. I wonder if that means if your supernormal powers are not complete and could be erroneous, if you get halfway through a wall and then can't get the rest of the way, you know, that would be a little challenging. Okay, then the reflection. First question, what are the six super knowledges and what are their functions? And the second question, reflect on the ways bodhisattvas use each super knowledge with compassion to benefit sentient beings. So please do that because, you know, if we can really think of the benefit of those powers with a mind of compassion. You know, for example, there's maybe somebody that you're quite close to and you can see maybe they're in mental turmoil, they're in physical pain, and you want to do something to help, but you don't know what. Ever been in that situation? Or you try something and it just isn't the right thing. I mean, your motivation is there, but what you did didn't fit. So, you know, when you think about those times in our unawakened life that are like that, then how nice it would be to actually have these powers and use them with compassion, not only for the people that we're close to, but for everybody, you know. Okay, then the next section is called Serenity in Buddhist Practice. So what makes the cultivation of serenity a Buddhist practice? Yeah? What makes it a Buddhist practice? Yeah, you do it with a mind of taking refuge. Yeah. The most important criteria is that it is held by refuge in the three jewels. What allows serenity to lead to nirvana and awakening? When the union of serenity and insight is coupled with the aspiration for liberation and the wisdom realizing emptiness, it leads to nirvana. When it is joined with bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness, the union of serenity and insight leads to full awakening. Yeah. If it's not conjoined with either of those motivations and without the wisdom realizing emptiness, then it's just, you know, worldly powers. Many of which people lose at death, actually. To ensure that our practice of serenity contributes to our ultimate spiritual aims, we should not seek meditative concentration to the exclusion of other practices especially when we are relatively new to Dharma practice. Analytical meditation on the stages of the path is necessary to cultivate a proper motivation and a firm foundation for practicing both serenity and insight. Interesting, huh? What do most Westerners want to do when they come to Buddhism? I want to learn to meditate. So I can have extraordinary experiences. Yeah, or is this just my generation when we heard, yeah, just, you know, it's like, yeah, this is, you know, I want something that's better than acid. Yeah. And, you know, if meditation does it, yeah, that's what I want. Well, if that's what you're looking for, probably acid will give it better to you than trying to develop these powers, because these powers take time and energy. And in the case of Buddhist practitioners, you have to do them with, you know, refuge in the three jewels and with wanting to use them to further your own path and to be a benefit to others as well. Okay. To ensure that our practice of serenity contributes to our ultimate spiritual aims, we should not seek meditative concentration to the exclusion of other practices, especially when we are new to Dharma practice. And then he talks again about analytical meditation on the stages of the path, Lam Rim meditation, you know, the ones that you do with an outline. Either you write it out or you have an outline in your mind, or you're reading a book and you do it paragraph by paragraph, you know. So that whole thing of really thinking about the teachings is so important, because unless we think deeply about the teachings and develop some conviction in them, then when some other teacher comes along teaching Ishka Baba Hoodoo, you know, it's like, that sounds really magical. I'm going to practice Ishka Baba Hoodoo Hoodoo. Yeah. And there you go. Yeah. So, you know, really understanding what the path is. What are the things, qualities we need to develop? What are the qualities that we need to abandon? Yeah, how did we develop these ones? How do we abandon these ones? You know, this is really important for us to learn, and then not just have that intellectual knowledge, but to meditate on the antidotes to the different afflictions by doing analytic meditation. Yeah, this is so important, because that is, I mean, it improves your mindfulness and introspective awareness. But also, when you know the Lam Rim well, and when you practice what's taught in the mind training text, the Lojung text, then you know how to solve your own problems. Yeah. And then if you go and do a retreat to develop serenity or insight, when different stuff comes up in your mind, you're not flummoxed like, oh no, you know, I just had a horrible memory and it threw me back to, you know, this, that horrible traumatic thing that happened. You know, if you are grounded in the Lam Rim and the thought training, then when that happens, you know how to deal with it. Yeah. When you haven't practiced Lam Rim and thought training, when your mind starts going cuckoo, you go cuckoo white with it. Yeah. And yeah. So important to do these meditations. So analytical meditation on the stages of the path is necessary to cultivate a proper motivation and a firm foundation for practicing both serenity and insight. without that foundation, why are you trying to develop those skills? What are you going to use them for? Yeah? If you have no idea what the path is, then, yeah, why do you want that? So he's going to tell a story now. There is the story of a meditator who spent so many years absorbed in the bliss of samadhi that his hair grew into long dreadlocks. Okay, you got the picture? Yeah. When he eventually arose from meditation, he noticed that some mice had nested in his beard and in his hair. Yeah. Furious, he swatted the mice and chased them away. Although this meditator had firm concentration, he lacked fortitude, such that a small provocation triggered a huge outburst of anger. Yeah. So the teachers tell many stories like that. Somebody who may have attained, you know, single-pointedness, and then some small thing happens and they explode because they don't know the Lam Rim, you know, and they've never really applied, you know, studied it and applied, let's say, the, you know, Shantideva chapter 6 or the mind training teachings for transforming adversity into the path. They've never learned them, never practiced them, yeah. So they may go to retreat for a long time, but then, you know, they get funny results. I know one person who, actually they had come here and had been with us for a while, not too long, a little while, but, you know, they hear about bodhicitta a lot and, you know, had been practicing that. And went to do a retreat to develop serenity. And at the end of the retreat, they ordained as a nun in another tradition. Yeah, a tradition that doesn't talk about bodhicitta. So that was interesting. Yeah, I know somebody else who did a 3-year retreat. Yeah, up in the mountains and, you know, and when she finished, she went back to get a graduate degree. I know somebody else who did Serenity Retreat. I don't know how far they got in this retreat, but they just know any of these people. I don't know their level that they are taking. But one person who was doing that for quite some time and then afterwards called me and said, you know, I'm going back to school. Can I give back my precept against taking intoxicants? That's what you learn for doing a long retreat, is that you want to take intoxicants? Yeah. So, yeah. So these are why our teachers give us the kind of advice that they do, you know, because otherwise so easy to, you know, kind of detour left, detour right. Yeah. Okay. That's. Most of our daily meditation practices involve both analytical and stabilizing meditation. To develop compassion, we employ analytical meditation to understand the kindness of others and their suffering in samsara. When compassion arises, we focus on that experience, that internal feeling or a compassionate experience. We focus on that with stabilizing meditation. Should compassion weaken, engaging in more analysis will reinvigorate it, at which point we resume stabilizing meditation on compassion. Most meditations on the stages of the path, most meditation on the stages of the path is done by alternating analytical meditation and stabilizing meditations in this way. Yeah, so you have your points that you're going to think about, the conclusion that you want to come to. You do, you know, you meditate on that doing analytical. And then at the end, whatever kind of feeling you have, or it could be a feeling, it could be a conceptual thing of, oh, I get it now, that kind of thing. Then you focus on that, you know, with stabilizing meditation, and just let your mind settle in that feeling or that knowledge. Yeah. Okay. During meditative absorption, a meditator may temporarily pass beyond manifest afflictions. So this is somebody in deep concentration. When you hear meditative absorption, it's not, you know, yeah, being able to focus for 5 or 10 minutes or something. Yeah. So during meditative absorption, a meditator may temporarily pass beyond manifest afflictions because they're being suppressed by the serenity, the dhyanas. But the enemy of afflictions will still still surface in post-meditation time. For this reason, we must not be satisfied with the bliss of concentration, but must develop insight into emptiness as well, for only that will free us from samsara. So you can have great single-pointedness when you come out of your meditation. You know, it's like, where's the chocolate? I feel like eating chocolate. Or, oh, somebody left this big mess. Why don't they learn to clean up after themselves? Or, you know, this guy who, the meditator who got so mad at the mice. Okay, however, without powerful concentration of serenity or the dhyanas, our understanding of emptiness will lack sufficient strength to serve as a counterforce to self-grasping ignorance. So we need both the understanding of emptiness and the power of serenity and higher meditative absorptions. Repeatedly entering into the realization of emptiness with single-pointed concentration is required to make the mind strong enough to uproot ignorance. This involves the unity of serenity and insight on emptiness. Okay, so you need that power. Otherwise, you know, you get a feeling for emptiness, and then the next moment it's gone. Or you get a feeling for anything in the next moment. Have you had that happen? You know, you have some feeling in a meditation, then next moment, gone with the wind, yeah? Okay, so this is why. So what he's doing here is he's really showing in this section, we need the factor of concentration, yeah? Otherwise, the realization of emptiness, bodhicitta, any of these things is not so strong, but the concentration is not enough. We could have the understandings of emptiness and compassion and bodhicitta, but if we don't have concentration, it comes and it goes. So he's really emphasizing the need for both these qualities and to unite them, the union of serenity and insight. Mm-hmm. That union of serenity and insight on emptiness, imbued with physical and mental pliancy induced by analytical meditation on emptiness. That union is a state imbued with physical and mental pliancy induced by analytical meditation on emptiness. Concentration alone can focus single-pointedly on emptiness, but analysis interrupts the stability of concentration. Analysis can plunge the depth of emptiness, but alone it cannot focus on emptiness single-pointedly. So uniting the two involves analysis being, this point is important. Uniting the two involves analysis being able to induce the physical and mental pliancy that bring deep concentration. Okay, remember when we were talking about the 9 stages of sustained attention? Yeah, and you had a physical pliancy, then mental pliancy, then mental pliancy, then mental bliss, then physical bliss. Okay, so you know, going through those, you need the power of concentration. Yeah, but with, if you're meditating on emptiness, you need the analysis so that you know what object you're meditating on. You know, you can't just sit there and say emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. That's not how you direct your mind to single-pointedness on emptiness. Okay, and what, you know, usually when you're developing just the stages of serenity, it's, you know, just your concentration brings about that kind, the physical and mental pliancy. Yeah, and analysis interrupts it, because analysis, you're thinking, and you're thinking about different topics and so on. But the special thing is when the union of serenity and insight is when the analysis itself can give rise to the pliancy. Yeah. Then you've united serenity and insight. And that gives you the ability to do analysis while your mind remains single-pointedly, without the analysis interrupting your concentration. Okay, now he's going to quote Tsongkhapa about this. Discerning wisdom becomes insight when, without focusing on a single object, it can generate pliancy through the power of analysis. So generating pliancy by setting your attention on a single object of meditation, even if that object is emptiness, is nothing more than a way to attain serenity. That alone does not count as attaining insight. So just meditating on emptiness is not necessarily insight. Yeah? Or just focusing single-pointedly on emptiness is not insight. You have to unite serenity and insight. I wonder if he's going to talk about the little fish. He hasn't talked about the little fish so far, has he? Okay, maybe I put it in another volume. But there's a passage in Lamrim Chenmo when he describes this, and let me get it straight. You know what? I'll wait and refresh my mind with this, because the little fish. Yeah, we'll wait on this one. Okay, continuing here. Meditating with pliancy and concentration on emptiness is serenity meditation. To become insight focused on emptiness, which itself is considered the union of serenity and insight, analysis must induce the pliancy of serenity. The sequence of first meditating on serenity and then insight pertains to when these two are being newly attained. Yeah, so usually, not always, there are sharp faculty disciples who go into and, you know, develop an understanding of emptiness first. But usually it's serenity you develop and then go into insight. Or, you know, now that does not mean that you don't study anything about emptiness until after you've generated serenity. It does not mean that. Okay, so you have to study, and there's a lot to learn to get the correct understanding of selflessness and emptiness. So you have to do that beforehand. Mm-hmm. So the sequence of first meditating on serenity and then insight pertains to when these two are being newly attained. After meditators have gained both of them, they can begin a meditation session with serenity, followed by insight, or they may directly enter into insight, because they've united them. Although attainment of serenity precedes attainment of insight, that does not mean that we should wait until we have full serenity before studying and contemplating the correct view. That's what I was just talking about. It is good to seek teachings on emptiness and gain familiarity with it as soon as we have generated understanding of the path. Okay? So that, you know, we should learn the basic idea behind emptiness and the object to be negated and how you go about doing it. And especially, how emptiness and dependent arising are not contradictory, but mutually beneficial. That's important to learn beforehand. In the perfection vehicle and the practice of the three lower tantras, serenity must be attained first. Although a meditator may have serenity, the stabilizing meditation of serenity and the analytical meditation of insight interfere with each other. They must be practiced alternately until analysis itself can induce the pliancy of serenity. He is really emphasizing that point. At that time, the union of serenity and insight is attained. When this powerful mind has emptiness as its object, the meditator enters the path of preparation. As mentioned, the process of attaining serenity and insight in highest yoga tantra differs. So with that, we will stop the teachings for this evening. Time for a few questions. Yeah? Yeah, wait for the microphone.
Yeah, I'm sorry if everybody already knows this, but I was just confused by some of the terms. Is analytical meditation a synonym for insight meditation, synonym for vipassana, or?
No, insight is, vipassana is translated as insight. Yeah, and analytical is referring to let me see if I have the Pali term in here. Analytical meditation, vikara bhavana. Yeah, vikara is one of the faculties where, that's found when you're in serenity, and then bhavana. That's analytical meditation.
I've heard of, like, we commonly hear the term vitakka vichara in describing first jhana. But I've never heard the term vichara bhavana, like the development of just vichara. So
huh.
I must look it up. But
yeah.
Is there a source for that term that
Got it out of some book.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. I'm sure now Google will find it if I just put it in.
Well, actually, yeah, this one was the Sanskrit word, vikara bhavana.
Okay.
The Tibetan is jagom.
Yeah. Could you tell me what pages you've read? Because I think I'm going to have to reread it. It's just
the pages,
all very new to me. So.
The pages I read today?
Yes, please.
Okay, where did we start? 253, and we're on 259 now.
Okay, this is the section on serenity. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Other questions? Oh, yeah.
I was a little puzzled when we got all the way back to when we were talking about the super knowledges, the knowledge of the destruction of the pollutants. Mm-hmm. It was just surprising to me to hear how you have to develop this to actually know where you are. I mean, I would always have assumed that you would know, like, when you're entering the path of seeing and so forth. Or this more about talking about the 9 levels of, or the 81 levels of the afflictions. Is it something that subtle that you have to have the special power to understand? Mm-hmm. Like, so you're going up through the paths, I would think you would know that you were passing out of the path of seeing into the path of meditation.
Yes, I would assume they would know that they had abandoned certain things. Yeah. I think at that level, they would probably know.
So I'm confused about what this kind of special pure ground attainment
special
is.
Special what?
The special pure ground attainment, the knowledge of the destruction of the pollutants, only arises as a special power.
Yeah, that's talking about arhatship, I think. Knowing that you have, abandoned the pollutants.
Okay.
Yeah, when you wake up in the morning, you know you have woken up.
Yes.
Okay. So I think that these beings, when you attain arhatship, you attain Buddhahood, you know it. Before you get, I'm guessing, that for most people, and this is why there's all these warnings and stories about people who think they have realizations who don't. Yeah. But at some point, when the higher paths, I think you know. But you can find somebody who has that realization and check it with them. Okay, I can't tell you from experience. Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to understand pliancy, and I found the definition, a mental factor that enables the mind to apply itself to a constructive object in whatever manner it wishes and dissipates mental or physical rigidity. What would be mental or physical rigidity?
Okay, mental rigidity, your mind is stuck. Mind ever been stuck?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Most of my life.
Yeah. So that's, I would say that that's mental rigidity. Physical rigidity, yeah, look at us walking up the stairs. yeah, those are gross examples of these things. Yeah. Okay, then we'll dedicate for the evening. Yeah, so these few days, it's kind of, the talks are to very different audiences who requested different teachers. So yesterday, it was a group who's doing a series on women teachers, and they requested a talk to help prepare people for taking Vajrayana empowerment. Today, where we're going through the class that we've been going through for quite a while, the section was, more on the super knowledges and, the unity of serenity and insight. Tomorrow I'm talking to a group in the Philippines, and they are asking questions about emotions. So it'll probably be mostly mind training teachings tomorrow. Then what? There's something.
Buddhist global relief.
Yeah, that's just an 8-minute talk. Yeah, for Buddhist global. But I'll give you the plug for it now, because I'm doing the talk in my room. Yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi, started this, and some other people started an organization called Buddhist World Buddhist Global Relief. And they focus primarily on food and sending food to all sorts of groups in all sorts of different countries. And I think they've done some on education too, which is really good. So they're having a fundraiser tomorrow, and they asked different people to give short talks about putting compassion in action. Yeah. So I don't know, when you talk about putting compassion in action, are you just talking about it, or are you putting compassion in action? You know, we'll find out. Yeah, so there's several people, so I got my slot. It's early in the thing, and then we're each given like 6, 7, 8 minutes to do our thing. Yeah. So you could probably tune in to BGR. Yeah. Website and listen to it. One person who's going to be speaking is somebody from, what did he say? Pakistan or Afghanistan or what?
He was one of the pro-Palestinian.
Oh, yeah, he was Palestinian. That was it. Yeah, he has a Palestinian friend who was at one of the schools, one of the universities. And so that Palestinian friend is a Buddhist. And so he's going to give one of these short talks tomorrow too. Okay. So BGF does very, very good. BGR does very good work. BGF is another organization. Okay.